Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Lolo, only on LA Talk Radio.
Guitar, an amazing instrument. It has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro and welcome to All About Guitar, where we talk tone, we talk technique, we talk gear. Where we discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies. Where we take a good look at everything guitar. And sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important. So we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to All About Guitar. We have a great show for you tonight. My guest is Carmen Grillo, and he's playing now. He's the guitarist for Sons of Champlin, but he's done a lot more and probably known a lot for playing guitar for Tower of Power. And he's in studio tonight, and he brought one of his guitars. Welcome. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks, Jeff. It's a happy time for everyone.
But just to give you a little background, he, besides Sons of Champlin and Tower of Power, he's played with Rita Coolidge, Smokey Robinson. He's done gigs with Huey Lewis in the News, Tim Weisberg, Tom Scott, Donna Summer. And we're going to talk about his new album tonight, A Different World, which is a great album, by the way.
Thank you.
You're going to hear some great tone and some great playing. I'm going to open up with Come and Gone. It's the opening tune of the album. And so let me play that, and then we'll get into the what you're using and all that stuff, all right. The good stuff.
Sounds good.
Here's Come and Gone. Great tune. Now, let's get down to business.
So, all right.
What were you using on that?
I was using this guitar that I'm holding in my hands right now, which is a Fernandez, kind of a custom built that it looks kind of like a Stratocaster, but it's a little bit smaller body, and it's contoured in the back like a Strat, and it's a very cool guitar. It has an ebony fingerboard, which has kind of a different tone than rosewood or a maple neck. It's a little spankier and a little darker at the same time, and that's it. It's got some kind of tricked out pickups by this company called Harmonic Design.
Harmonic Design,
which is not a very popular company here in the United States. They make pickups mostly for Japanese guitars, but the way that I came about to know about these is when I was endorsed by Fernandez when I was in Tower Power. They used to send me to different guitar stores to do these clinics. And I did one locally, and they said, well, you don't have to bring your guitar. We got tons of Fernandez guitars here. So I said, okay, great. Just walk in and play.
Mm-hmm.
And so they handed me a Fernandez guitar, and I was playing, and I'm going, wow, this thing sounds amazing. You know, I mean, I like my Fernandez, but this, what's going on with this? He goes, well, we're trying out this guy's pickups, you know, this company's name, Harmonic Design. And I said, well, give me his number, because I got to have these. So now all my guitars, I have a Les Paul and two of these Fernandez and a Telecaster, and they all have this guy's pickups.
So you even put them on the Les Paul,
yeah,
too?
Yeah, I put them on the Les Paul. They're just amazing pickups. They just kind of...
It sounds good. I mean, well, yeah. And you were using that on that opening clip, right?
Yeah.
You're using that guitar. Now, do you know what that body is? Is that an Alder, or what kind of body do you
know? I think it is Alder. It's very light, so it probably is Alder. I couldn't be completely certain about that, but I believe that it is Alder.
Oh, okay. And you like the ebony over the rosewood?
I do. You know, my other Fernandez guitar has an ebony neck on it, or ebony fingerboard on it as well. And it's just kind of got a really cool sound for rhythm. It's real chunky. And for lead, it just seems like it has a little bit more sustain.
Yeah.
You know, a little bit throatier, you know.
Show us a little bit of the different tone. I mean, go through your pickup settings and show us what you're, you know, well, give us an idea.
Well, the neck pickup. This is the neck in the middle. Kind of a stratty kind of thing. And it also has this mid-range cut, which really works great in this position, too. And then with the mid-range, that's with the mid-range cut.
So you have a volume, mid-range cut, and a tone.
That's right.
That's how it's set up.
Mm-hmm.
You have a five-position switch,
that's
and
correct.
Then you have a toggle there.
Right, this toggle turns the humbucking that's in the bridge pickup into a single coil.
Oh, okay. Splits that.
And I don't even think that that's connected, but it's there just to make people think I'm doing something.
But you get that the neck pickup, it sounds almost like a humbucker, like a...
Yeah, yeah, they're very strong pickups, but they still have like the stratty kind of quacky, what I call the mm-hmm. duck. Quacky kind of sound, you know.
Yeah, it's got that sound. I mean, I love that opening cut. That's great. What amp were you using for that?
I was using a Mesa Boogie Rectoverb
mm-hmm.
on that particular cut for the rhythm and the lead. I played Boogie amps for most of my career, and I just recently changed to a different amp that is not on this particular album. It's called a Red Plate. You ever heard of Red
Plate?
Yes,
Red Plate, yes.
Man, it's really something.
Those are nice. Now, did you use Mesa Boogie for Tower?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
And you're using the Red Plate now for Sons of Chaplin?
Yes, I am.
Yes. No, those Red Plates are really...
It's really a little bit different than the Boogie. It's a little less forgiving, you know what I mean? The Boogies kind of compress a little bit, which is great. I mean, I always loved my Boogies. I got nothing bad to say about them. They're really, really fine, great amplifiers. But the Red Plate is just a little bit more... focused and a little less compressed, you know.
Right. So is it like I'm trying to think. It's like, for example, Matchless, where the amp is, it's not as much of a preamp type of overdrive. It's more of just the amp is just loud and clean.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like those Matchless too. Those are fine.
They're great. They're loud, but they get, when you crank them up, they start speaking.
They got really, really nice beefy tone.
Yeah. Now, did you in the studio? Did you use any other? Do you have any other amps that you use just for recording, like any of the Fenders or Marshalls?
Yeah, I use a Fender Deluxe and a Fender Blues Deluxe.
Mm-hmm.
And those are like the Red Plate and the Fender Deluxe and the Fender Blues Deluxe are what I use mostly. And there's a song on my album called Transatlantic Boogie.
Mm-hmm.
Boogie makes an amplifier, a little 22-watt amplifier called the Transatlantic. Mm-hmm. So Mesa makes this Transatlantic, and on that Transatlantic Boogie, there's a lot of, if you really listen to it, there's a lot of different sounds on it, because I was kind of experimenting. I just got the amp, so I was, like, going through all the things that it did, and I used, you know, multiple sounds on that. If you really listen to it, there's, like, a lot of overdubbing with a lot of different type of sounds going on in
well,
that particular cut.
Well, I'm going to play that since I have a clip of that, but I wanted to ask you that there's like this really low rhythm guitar and it's clean, and usually when you get that low in your that it kind of bottoms out, but the amp doesn't bottom it out. Is that that little amp?
That's that little amp. everything that my rhythm playing and lead playing on that track is all with the Transatlantic Boogie, which gave it its name.
Okay, well, here, let's take a listen to that, and you can hear what we're talking about. Here's Transatlantic Boogie. So there's some really cool things you're doing. That low guitar, I mean, I was like, is it gonna? It's not bottoming out. How did he do that?
Well, that was just the amp, really. You know, I mean, it's got for a 22 watt amp, it's got a ton of headroom, mm-hmm. and plus I was using a closed back 212 speaker cabinet with it.
So you had it in a 212. That's interesting.
Yeah, I just had the head, and then mm-hmm. I had a Boogie Mesa cabinet with 212s in it. Mm-hmm. And that kind of gave me the low end without it breaking up too much too.
Now the speakers that you're using, are those just Celestians, or are you using any special ones?
Oh, well, the Mesa stuff has their own speaker, but I believe they are made by Celestian.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So you're just using what's stock for
the... It's called the Black Shadow, I think, the Mesa Black Shadow.
Okay.
Speaker.
And then what are you using for the red plate?
Oh, the red plate is a Celestian Vintage 30.
Oh, okay.
It's a 50-watt head.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the loudest 50 watts you'll ever hear.
So you use one 50-watt with Sons of Champlin? Is that
yeah.
what you're using live?
Mm-hmm.
And then with a 212 cabinet?
112 open back.
112 open back.
Yeah.
Wow. Vintage 30-watt. And then what was that? What was the other one in the Transatlantic? What was the name of that speaker?
It's called the Black Shadow, Mesa Black Shadow speakers.
Black Shadow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I believe there's some type of, they're made by Celestian, but I think they're made to Mesa's specifications.
So you have that rhythm guitar, and then you, the main lead, and then there's, at the very end, you hear this other lead over on the left.
Right.
Now, is that the same guitar?
Same guitar, same amp with a different setting.
Different setting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Transatlantic Boogie is like having six amplifiers. The reason they call it Transatlantic is because it has like one side with three settings, mm-hmm. Kind of like Fender-ish, and then they have the other side of it, which is, you know, kind of more like a, either like the clean sound is kind of like a high watt, and the breakup sound is kind of like a Marshall. You know?
Yeah.
So it's like,
well, that first lead, you get that kind of blown out, you know, Marshall blowout sound. And then that other guitar in there, it's kind of like that. It has a little more Fender character.
Yeah, I think what I was using on that sound that you're talking about, it was the actual the Mesa preset. It's not really a preset. You got to twist the knobs, but they have these little templates in the owner's manual. Thank God, so people like me can figure out how to make it sound good.
No,
but yeah, that's the Mesa setting on that. But it's kind of like a Tweed or a Deluxe and a Mesa on one side, and then a Hi-Watt and an AC30 and a Marshall on the other side.
Yeah, no, it's a pretty
a cool amp.
It's a really versatile amp.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your background and your influences and stuff. So let's go back to Santa Cruz.
Oh, God. Okay. The retirement town for young people.
So you were originally from New York, and then you moved over to Santa Cruz.
I did.
What was the music scene there when you were growing up?
It was incredible. It was an incredible training ground for me. There were so many great musicians there, great keyboard players, great guitar players that came through there. And one guy that I studied with for a while, not really long time, but maybe I took maybe like 8-9 lessons from this guy, and I'm still trying to work out what he taught me. He was amazing. He was like, you know, there's certain times in life when you just, you know, life changing experiences. He was really a life changing experience for me as far as my took my playing to another level.
What were your big influences? What would you listen to as a kid? Were you, I mean, obviously Beatles, Hendrix type stuff?
Well, I loved Jimi Hendrix, but I wasn't really like into emulating him at all. I was more into the Clapton camp, I think. You know,
And
more into the Jeff Beck camp. You know, and of course, Jimmy. How can you? I mean, there's nothing like that. That's amazing. But he never really was a big influence on me. I went from like Wes Montgomery and Les Paul to Eric Clapton and Jeff Beck, you know, whoever was in between there, you know.
But you're mentioning some other guys more. So you were aware of jazz and you were into a lot of the jazz stuff.
Yeah, too. I was into Wes Montgomery. I was not that I play like him at all, you know, but I loved listening to it and I loved learning his tunes. I had a big fat Gibson at the time when I was trying to figure out what Wes was doing, but it never really. Maybe the phrasing at some point, you know, kind of is influential in my style, but as far as tone and his approach to guitar is really not my approach. But I just think he harmonically, there's really nobody better than Wes.
Yeah, no, that's true. But your tone is interesting because that type of bluesy sound. It's not as Clapton-y. It's more. I mean, there were a bunch of players. Well, Tower of Power, the original Tower of Power, too.
Right.
Were you influenced a lot by the San Francisco scene, or were you?
The original Sons of Champlin guitar player Terry Haggerty, he definitely was a huge influence on me. Because at that particular time, I was digging the Sons. And I was also studying what the guy I was telling you about. His name was Dale Ramey. I don't think he's around anymore. But he was a very jazz-oriented guitar player. And, but I was kind of a rock guy. So I would, like, take what he taught me, and I would, like, just put it in a whole different context. You know, and that's how we came up with you called it fusion-y a little earlier before we started, but I call it blusion. It's my own word.
Well,
it's fusion.
Speaking of blusion, I'm going to play a clip which I think exemplifies that. Is I Got the Sauce.
Okay.
So let's play that, and you'll hear what we're talking about.
It's
here.
It's about my cooking.
It's about your cooking.
Yes, it is.
Okay, here we go. I Got the Sauce. Great cut.
Thank you.
Great cut. Now, that's the Fernandez?
No, that is actually a Les Paul, and that's, of course, that's Rocco Prestia on bass. I was mainly, when we were just listening to that, I didn't even hear what I was playing. I mean, every time he's around, it just, my ears kind of just gravitate towards what he's doing.
Yeah, that's a great bass line.
He's the most amazing. You know, he plays like the unthinkable, unplayable stuff on every song. And I actually had the opportunity to produce his one and only solo album, and, you know, and part of what he was asking me, he said, well, how do we make a bass album? I said, well, every album you've ever made is a bass album. You
know, yeah,
so
that's
just play.
Just go for it.
Yeah.
No, that's great. And then, so that's the Les Paul, and then what amp were you
using? That's a Les Paul, and that is a Mesa Original Mark One.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
A Mesa
that
Mark
I've had
One.
For like 35 some years.
Those are nice amps.
Yeah. This one is actually a prototype of the Mark One. It actually has like the dynamo tape on the back, mm-hmm. where the speaker is. You know, they didn't even have any type of, how do you say it? The stencil, you know, where they
right.
on the, you know, this is the speaker, this is the reverb and all that.
Now, what speaker, the early ones they were using JBLs, if I'm correct. Is that a JBL?
It is not a JBL. That, again, is another Black Shadow, Mesa Black Shadow speaker. That was,
so it's a newer speaker, because they didn't make the Black Shadow back then, did they?
I think they did. I mean, I don't remember ever changing the speaker out on this thing, so I believe it's the Mesa Black Shadow. I think it's,
wow.
Yeah, I think they've had them for quite a while.
I didn't know that they had made them that long. I
might be lying to you. I mean, it may have had something in it, and I have just forgotten.
Whatever
like
it
I
is,
said,
it sounds
killer.
I had it
for 35 years.
Now, that at that time when you recorded that with that Les Paul, is that with those new pickups, or is that?
Yeah, it is with the harmonic design pickups.
Those are very nice.
Yeah, if you go to their website, there's a lot of different choices of things that they make, you know. And like I said, it's kind of an underground company. The guy is really low-key. I don't know if he promotes himself as much as a lot of other pickup companies do, but I just fell in love with the sound of this guy's pickups.
Well, no, I can see why. Well, let's talk a little bit about how you fell into the gig with Tower of Power, because I want to get into your guitar playing with brass and stuff, and we mm-hmm. got some clips of that that's on the album. You have a lot of brass on your album.
I had to do it.
That's
I can't
okay.
get away from it.
But so how did that happen? How did you get into that?
I had heard that there was an audition for a guitar player for Tower, and I went and auditioned with a bunch of other guys, and a couple of weeks went by. I didn't hear anything, so I called Emilio Castillo, who's the leader of the band. I called him up after about... It seemed like it was longer than 2 weeks, but it was like somewhere mm-hmm. around close to 3 weeks. And he goes, oh, I'm glad you called. And this is how he hired me. He goes, we're going to try it with you. And so I ended up being in the band for 10 years. And after I was in it for 8 years, I said, so do I have the gig, or are we still trying?
We're still trying.
He goes, nah, you got the gig.
Well, now, before that, had you played in a band with horns before?
Yeah, all my bands in Santa Cruz were horn bands.
Oh, okay. So
we actually opened up for Tower, you know, as early as 1974, my band opened up for mm-hmm. Tower. And then played with them again, like in, you know, 76 and 77.
Well, playing in a
but
band...
I never met them until they, yeah. you know, until I auditioned.
But playing in a band like that with that many players, and with all those guys, and they're, you know, they can solo too. I mean, that's one of the best horn sections.
Sure.
But even with your other bands and your players in there, how did you approach putting your guitar in? Because, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on
yeah.
in there, and you have to find that, you know, you got to find the little gaps
right.
where you can
you
go.
My whole approach... And I don't know how I came about this, but I found like the best way to when there's a lot of people on stage is to try to play whatever the drummer's playing on his hi-hat. You know that.
Okay.
And you know, because a hi-hat, you don't really think about it taking up a lot of space, but usually in a funk situation like Tower or some of my earlier bands, you know, the hi-hat was very you know, intricate. You know.
Okay.
And so I would, you know, the. But, you know.
So you're basically.
So I really played.
You were playing like a percussion.
It was a
part.
Musical hi hat. Yeah. Really is what my rhythm guitar playing is.
Mm-hmm. And the, but now and also too soloing. Well, I'm going to play a cut. We were talking a little bit about your soloing. There's a cut I have here that it shows. You know, you're working with the you do a line with the brass. It's called this one's called Prototype,
mm-hmm.
and you're playing the line with the brass.
Right. Well, it's actually me and Tom Scott playing the line. I wanted to get kind of an LA Express type of thing. You know, I don't know if some of your listeners, if they haven't heard of LA Express, it was Tom Scott and Robin Ford,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
they played a lot of guitar saxophone heads together, and I wanted to get that sound. And Tom Scott was over in my studio doing a session for somebody else, and I asked him. I said, "Man, I got this tune. I'd really like to get like an LA Express kind of a vibe on it. Would you mind playing on it?" And he goes, "Ah, I'd love to." You know, so I taught it to him, and he played it, and it really really came out great. I love that sound of a tenor sax and guitar playing the same line. I think
yeah,
that's
you
really
you it. Double on the line, and but I also notice is your phrasing with him is. You're right, spot on. You guys phrase together well. That I mean, I presume that's just from playing with all those different players over the years. You're.
It's kind of a horn line, you know, and so it was. And I actually put my part on first, so he matched me.
Oh, okay.
But it is kind of a horn influenced line, you know, which made it easy for Tom. I mean, Tom could play anything anyway, but it made it easy for him to just
right.
go, oh, yeah.
But do you think, I mean, in your phrasing, do you think like a horn?
In one respect, I do. A lot of guitar players can wail forever without stopping. And I try to approach it more like as if I were a horn player and I had to take a breath, because I think it makes it more interesting solo-wise to have some space. And if you're playing music with your face, you have to actually take a breath. So I try to look at that.
That's true. You do pause like if a horn player would take a breath.
That's kind of something that I consciously make an effort to do.
Now, when you recorded your guitar part first, like you said, was that all written out, or did he just listened to it and did it by ear?
I did. You know, it happened so spontaneously. I didn't have it written out. I just he just heard it and learned.
He
it.
He just didn't write.
Yeah, because he's Tom Scott.
Yeah, he's Tom Scott. Yeah, but I mean, well, let's take a listen to the clip and we'll get a little more into it. But
all right.
So everybody understands what's going on. But this is Prototype. some great playing.
Wow, I have to relearn that. That was fun.
You got to do that live. You got to do that.
We're gonna play that when I'm playing a show with Will Champlin and Tamara Champlin at Bogey's in Westlake, and this is one of the songs that we are going to play.
That's cool. Because are you gonna have? Is there gonna be a sax player?
There won't be unless somebody comes and wants to sit in, and then I will show it to them very quickly because it's not really that difficult of a tune.
I love that doubling. It's really cool.
I've never listened to it in headphones before. It's pretty. It is effective. I've always listened to it. I mixed it. I put it through. My speaker. I don't usually like to mix in headphones, but it's kind of interesting to listen to in headphones.
A lot of space and depth. That's a good mix. Very clean, and there's a lot of room in there.
Yeah, there's some clavinet going on in there, and Fender Rhodes, played by Rob Mullins. I don't know if you know Rob.
Rob Mullins,
just an incredible.
And that's a great bass part too.
Oh, thanks.
Who was playing?
Mark Meadows is the bass player on that. He played with Edgar Winter, and he also played with Johnny Guitar Watson back in the day.
No, that's great. Now, what were you using guitar and amp-wise on that?
That was this guitar, again, this Fernandez guitar, and that was my Mesa Rectoverb.
Mesa Rectoverb, oh, wow.
That's a great amp. I love that amp.
You're getting a lot of sounds that, you were getting that kind of a Robin Fordish type of, and I forget what he was using. Did he use a...
He's got a Dumble.
Dumble now, yeah. But I think he was using Fenders before, right?
Yeah, probably back in the day. I think that's all there was around.
Yeah, but it has that kind of sound to it. Yeah. Which that's what the Boogies always had that.
Yeah.
They could get that and still crunch.
Right.
You could get between the two.
I think those guys are, everybody at the place, I've been to their factory. Everyone there is a guitar player, and everybody's in a room, tweaking, playing and trying to make it better. So there's just really... the company really cares about their product, and they're always to this day 20 amps behind back ordered. people are still buying them all the time.
There's no doubt about it. They're great amps. But now with Tower of Power, did you get to try? I mean, we know that the classic hits and stuff, and there's the brass and the guitar is a lot of its rhythm with maybe a lead. But did you get to do stuff like where you double lines like that, like you did with the Tom Scott?
There was a couple of tunes that Greg Adams, I think one, and I can't remember the name of it, but there was one song that Greg Adams wrote that I played the line along with the horn section. And actually, there's one song called "A Little Knowledge Is a Dangerous Thing," and the guitar part, the guitar solo, I think, kind of. There's a little doubling going on at the beginning of it or the ending of it. I can't remember exactly, but that's a really cool tune guitar-wise. There's a really cool little rhythm line in it, and I got to let it fly solo-wise. In a horn band like that, you got to pick your spots. I didn't get to carry the ball all that often, but it was cool. It was cool being a part of something like that. It was such a big unit and it was such a machine. We had to. There's not a lot of room, what we were talking about before about being in horn bands. It has to be the same every night. There's no room to, I got an idea, I think I'm going to try tonight. It doesn't work. The thing is a well-oiled machine, and you go in there and you do your job every night, which is to play.
So coming into the right gig, thing. You had to pretty much follow what the albums were doing.
Emilio likes everybody who knew that comes into the band to bring whatever they have to the table, but you have to have respect for what came before you.
Right.
That's the way I approached it. Bruce Conti invented those guitar parts, there's really no other way to play in that band in particular tunes Down to the Nightclub. You can't play a different guitar part. You got to play that part, and so there's not a lot of room for creativity rhythm wise unless we made four albums while I was in the band, and I got to make up my own parts and stuff like that, which was great, but as far as playing the older stuff, I played them as close to Bruce as I could, because that's the gig.
Yeah, that's the but now But in terms of you, like you said, each guy would bring in their own thing to it. What do you think you brought to them?
Well, I brought songwriting. Not that they didn't have that before, but I had a little bit of a twist on my songs, and we recorded quite a few of my songs. And I brought a high vocal part that I always got stuck with because I could do it, you know. So I always ended up on the notes that are way high. But I was actually just listening to something that I found on the internet, a live performance of us, and the vocals were really tight. They really sounded great. Mm-hmm. And I think I brought a lot vocally, arrangement-wise, vocally, you know, I used to dish out parts to the other guys and stuff.
So on the new albums, it was collaborative. Everybody pitched in, and wasn't like, you know, they would just tell you what to do.
No, it was everybody was, you know, the way we would approach it whenever we had, you know, we had an A&R guy at Epic Records, and when we were coming up against doing a new album, we would all be writing as much as we could, and we would demo the songs in my studio, which was cool, you know, and then we would give the songs to the A&R guy, and we'd let the A&R guy pick the songs. That way we wouldn't have to fight each other. And you know, it was like, oh, man, I want my song. No, man, I want my song. You know, that guy, he let him be the bad guy, so we wouldn't fight amongst ourselves, you know. So it was great to have an A&R guy. And he chose the tunes, and when we came up with songs, we would, you know, the rhythm section would sit together, and we would work out, you know, our parts to the song, and we would make a little demo tape of just the rhythm section and the structure of the song, and then we would give it to Greg Adams, and he would sit in the corner and write, you know, amazing horn parts in about 20 minutes, you know, five parts without a piano, you know. I've never seen, you know, I know there are other arrangers that do it this way, but I've never even seen Greg get close to a piano. He's just sits there. He's got it tattooed in his brain, you know. He just, you know, he'd write two measures at a time, five parts. And then they would all get in a circle, and they would play it down. And, you know, Greg might make a couple of voicing changes. He would, like, switch up the second tenor with the second trumpet or something. You guys switch notes or something like that. Mm-hmm. You know? I mean, he was just amazing to watch him, you know, come up with the incredible stuff. I don't think we ever threw away anything that he wrote.
Wow.
It was literally everything he wrote was perfect. You know, he's an amazing musician.
Now, let's take a look. How did it, besides the size of the band, what was the change, or what's the approach for Sons of Champlin as opposed to Tower of Power? How's your function in that? And did you have to emulate all the original parts?
Not really. You know, a lot more freedom for me to do whatever I want. You know, I actually chose to start off some of Terry's solos the way that Terry did them, because I just think they're kind of classic, and you know, I would start it off the way that he did it, and then I would do my own thing. You know, but that's my own choice. I mean, nobody told me to do that, or if I didn't do that, no one would get mad at me or anything.
You know,
but it's a pretty free band as far as being the guitar player. You know, the Sons are, and Bill's always had a great guitar player, you know, with him, so you know, it's a big responsibility on me to fill Terry's shoes, because Terry's he's just an amazing guitar player.
Right. So, well, is Bill playing more keyboards, or is he playing?
He's
guitar?
Playing mostly keyboards in the Sons.
So what is it? Keyboards, bass, guitar,
we
and drums.
We have two keyboard players, and one of the keyboard players doubles on vibes. So it's either organ and vibes, or electric piano and organ, or you know, electric piano and guitar, or two guitars and organ, you know, so we can kind of do the Chinese fire drill in between dunes, and we all like
so you got to fill it up more.
Yeah, there's more room. You know, we do have three horns, but it's not really, you know, Tower of Power is a horn band, and the Sons is a band with horns, if you can kind of decipher.
So you do have horns. So you still have it's a pretty big sound as it is.
Yeah.
So, well, that's it. And now, have you been writing for Sons, or are you still?
No, we do some of my tunes off the album. But as far as the writing, we're not really writing anything new, because most of the people that come to see us, they kind of want to hear, mm-hmm. you know, the old Suns stuff, because it's kind of their soundtrack to their life. Mm-hmm. you know, they're such big, huge fans. You know, huge fans.
And yeah.
And they love Bill, and they love the Suns' music, and we just kind of, you know, give them what they want, which is mm-hmm. that stuff, you know.
But there are like 5 albums or something, right? There's quite a few albums.
Oh, God.
Yeah, plenty of material,
yeah.
So.
Yeah, there's plenty.
There's a lot of stuff to draw from, mm-hmm. yeah. And we, you know, try to change it up, because a lot of times, you know, the Suns, the same people come to all the shows, so we try to switch it up for them so they don't come and see the same thing every time we
yeah.
play.
But also, too, playing that broad of a repertoire of music, you know, when you're playing one of the early Champlin song, the Sons of Champlin songs, are you trying to emulate the sound of that era, or are you just kind of just doing your thing?
I'm doing my thing. I think if I were to emulate the sound of that era, it would be too much like me trying to be someone I'm not.
Okay.
I mean, like, I'm not Terry, you know. I mean, me and Terry are really good friends. I don't really play like him. He has some influence on my playing, but he knows that I don't play like him, and I know that I don't play like him. So for me to have, like, the big hollow body Gibson that Terry used to play back in the early Suns, you know, for me to do that, it would just kind of be me trying to be Terry, and mm-hmm. that's really not what I want to do, and I don't think anybody wants me to do that.
You know, okay.
So I'm free to be.
It's much more a looser thing.
It is.
Yeah, and now I'm gonna play another clip from the album, A Different World. This is a different piece, totally in left field, because it features you on acoustic guitar.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to play this, and what I want people to notice, I mean, it's a vocal song, so you're singing, but listen to how the guitar just goes around the vocal and how it works with the vocal, because even though it's finger picking accompaniment, it kind of counterpoints what's happening on the vocal. And this song is called You're the One, and I want to, because we're almost out of time, and I want to play this because it's the one song that's totally different than all the other stuff,
and that's why it's the last tune on the album, because it's just kind of like good night everybody.
Yeah, but it's a beautiful little song. But I mean, the guitar playing, it's just another aspect of what you do that maybe people don't really, you know, you don't get to do in Tower of Power or even in the Sons of Champlin. But anyway, listen to this. This is You're the One, and this is some of the best acoustic guitar. This is really tasty stuff. Here you go.
You're the one. You're the one. No one can take your place. Searching everywhere under the sun, I finally found my soul deep within someone. Here we are, right where we belong. We've come so far, whether every morning I wake up with you by my side. You're the one. You're the one. If you take a little look inside, you'll find it's all for you. Could I fall?
Some great changes.
Nice fade, Jeff. Thanks.
I never get enough chance to play. I mean, you don't have enough time to play the whole clip,
that's
and I
cool.
have to tastefully bring
yeah, right.
it up.
You did and, good, man.
And I'll be honest with you, your album's tough to condense, because I'll be listening to something like, okay, that's good. I'm going to use that lead there. And then all of a sudden you do something else. And it's like, it's already two minutes.
That's a good thing. At least it's interesting.
Yeah, no. And I have to stress that. There's just so many little things that are going on in the album and all the different cuts. There's a lot of cool things that you can learn in terms of just tasty guitar work. And especially that. It's just those changes are just awesome.
Thank you.
But on to more important things. What were you using? What was your guitar?
That's a Guild. What model is that? I don't even know. It's a Guild acoustic that I bought on eBay. That's the best I can tell you.
Okay.
You know, the Dreadnought.
Is it an old one?
Yeah, it's an older one.
Older Guild. It's a beautiful sounding guitar.
Yeah, it's a great guitar. I mean, then try to think. Well, what I use on a microphone for that is a Neumann KM56. Which is a really interesting microphone.
How far away from it?
About 9 inches.
So you're recording mono about 9 inches away?
Yeah,
I recorded
in mono.
Near the neck or down by the...
About the 12th fret pointed towards the sound hole. That's kind of where I like to put the mono.
No, it's clean and all the articulate, all the stuff that you can hear. Again, those inner voices when you're playing those chords, those changes, it's clear.
Yeah, a lot of open strings.
It's gorgeous.
That's a standard tuning, right?
Yeah.
That's standard tuning. No, that's a beautiful song. I had to play that because it's just like, whoa.
Yeah, you know? Thank you for playing it.
It was really good. Now, we're almost out of time, so we're going to talk before we leave. We're going to play this one clip to take us out, but I wanted you to explain a little bit your approach to it. But before we do that, let's talk about where you're playing and get that. Let people know where you're going. So tell us what's happening.
Okay. Well, you're going to play Real Mother for You, which is Johnny Guitar Watson's mm-hmm. tune. And it's in F minor for all you guitar guys out there. And like what I like to...
Hold on 1 second.
Okay.
Before you do that, we need to talk... I want to announce before we... Because we're going to go right into the clip. Okay,
sure.
Is where you're playing.
Okay.
So Lori...
Carmen mentioned before. So I'll just mention it one more time. So next Sunday, the 7th of May... it's actually Tamara Champlin and Will Champlin, Bill and Tamara's son, as a special guest, and then the band, which includes Carmen as well as Dave Murata on bass and David Raven on drums. And who knows what special guest? Gary usually shows up, Gary Falcone, and
who knows,
Who knows who. So, yes, it's at Bogey's in Westlake Village, and the show starts, I believe, at 7, but...
I think it's 6.
Might be 6, yeah. Be safe and come at 6, and come have a drink and sit on the outside patio. It's beautiful, and this will be...
great place to see.
And where
Carmen plays there with other configurations as well, so...
To get tickets or whatever.
There's no advance tickets. Just come.
Just come.
Yeah, just come. You can call Bogey's to make a table reservation. That would be great.
Yeah.
There's good food there and easy parking and very, very beautiful grounds. Mm-hmm. It's in the Westlake Village Center. So
And repeat the date again?
The date is the 7th of May. Just coming up this coming Sunday.
This coming Sunday.
Yeah.
Okay, now let's talk about that song.
Okay, so this is a Real Mother for You, and it's an F minor. It goes a couple other different places, but mm-hmm. but you wanted me to talk about my solo approach to this. So if we're in F minor, you know, that you have to think about the tonal center of F minor, which is mm-hmm. you know, F minor would be the 2 mm-hmm. of the tonal center, which would be the E flat. So mm-hmm. I like to base something that's in F minor or E flat on the 4th interval of the tonal center, which would be mm-hmm. A flat. So basically, what you're doing is if you're playing F minor, you're playing an A flat Lydian, which is an E flat scale starting mm-hmm. on the A flat. Right? Mm-hmm. And so then you can arpeggiate those. Right? And then there's other mm-hmm. legs. You know, there's this... It gives you a different place to play. Like, usually in F minor, guys are here. Or here. Mm-hmm. But this... You know, it just gives you different places to play. So trying to think of F minor as a E flat Lydian, which is based on an E flat scale starting on the fourth interval of the E flat scale, mm-hmm. which is an A flat, and you'll find a lot more different places to play solo wise, and it'll open up a lot of things. And I try to use the scale wise. I try to use three fingers per string. That's one string. That's yeah. another string. That's another string.
That's interesting because
that's another string.
Because when I studied with Duke Miller, and who taught Lee, that was his whole thing: three on a string.
Yeah, that's a good approach. Yeah, it's very really guitar friendly. You know?
Very. But that's where you basically were pulling your melody out of when you're playing your lead on that.
Right.
Was from that.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we're gonna play that this clip, and. I want to thank Lori for being on the show and also
thank you
and,
for also just introducing me to Carmen and making this happen. And the album is Carmen Grillo, A Different World.
Yeah, and you can get that on Amazon or iTunes or my website, which is carmengrillo.com. Yeah.
And if you're local, come to the show. Bring some CDs.
I'll bring some CDs and I'll hawk them.
Yay.
So this is a real mother for you.
Yeah.
And thank you again.
Yeah,
everybody
you,
have
Jeff.
A great week.
And thank you, Lori.
And we will see you next week. And here you go.